Welcome to Revolutionize Your Retirement Radio, bringing you insights and strategies to help you create a magnificent and fulfilling second half of life. Here's your host, certified professional retirement coach and best-selling author, Dr. Dorian Mintzer.
I want to welcome everyone to my Revolutionize Your Retirement Interview with Experts series. I'm Dori Mintzer, owner of Revolutionize Retirement and your host, and introduce you to Lori. Lori Bitter provides strategic consulting, research, and development for companies seeking to engage with mature consumers at the business of aging. Her recent research, Hacking Longevity, which we're going to hear about today, sponsored by AARP and Procter & Gamble, has just launched its second study on key life shifts in later life. Lori was named a Next Avenue Influencer in Aging. Her book is called The Grandparent Economy, and it's a National Mature Media Award winner. She serves as co-producer of What's Next Boomer Business Summit and the Silicon Valley Boomer Venture Summit. She has more than 30 years of advertising, public relations, and strategic planning experience. She serves on the advisory board of several startups and nonprofits. Lori's a sought-after speaker, and she's presented research, trends, and analysis about mature consumers and the opportunities of the longevity marketplace to more than 200 conferences and events in the United States, the United Kingdom, and Europe. She's been featured in Forbes and Entrepreneurs 100 to Watch and appeared on CNBC. I met Lori a number of years ago at the Boomer Summit, and one of the Boomer Summits always happens during the ASA, the American Society on Aging Conference, and I met her then, and then I've seen her other times at other conferences, and I just finished reading her book, The Grandparent Economy, and it's excellent. Lori, different from many of us on the call, has this marketing and advertising background, and it's really interesting to think about both the book as well as what her research is, because, you know, she's really talking about both the longevity revolution and what that means in terms of us as consumers, influencers, and purchasers. So it's a really, really going to be interesting. It's very interesting. So I really do recommend it. So Lori, without further ado, as they say, welcome. And you know, I thought maybe we could begin on just how you got interested in grandparenting and maybe a bit about your first book, The Grandparent Economy, and then we can move on to the research and all of that. So welcome.
Well, thank you for that lovely introduction. The grandparent, you know, I sort of joke with people when they ask about sort of how I got into this space. And I was raised by my grandparents. And so I've been around older people my entire life. So it always seems sort of odd to me that other people didn't sort of understand and know that older people have different different need states and different product needs. It just sort of was always part of my world. And so probably 10 years ago now, when I still owned an advertising agency, we did a big project for AARP around grandparents. And they were really trying to understand grandparents as consumers. They were trying to understand what was going on with grandparents raising grandchildren, grandparents' rights, just sort of a really broad stroke overview of what was going on in space. So we did a lot of research, and we were given access to a lot of their existing research too. And as we were creating what ended up being about a 20-page report, I looked at the stacks of research on my desk and said, this is the most compelling life shift I've ever taken a deep dive into, because the spending that goes on when people become a first-time grandparent is like off the charts relative to other life shift changes, other than maybe caregiving when someone becomes a caregiver for someone else. And we had all of this, what I would call leftover research, just sitting there. And everyone had been asking me when I was going to write a book about the older adult economy. And I said, you know, I'll write a book when I have something to say that someone else hasn't already said. I don't want to clutter the book environment. I want to have something new to say. And I finally sort of woke up one morning and went, this is what's new. I mean, this is this is something people haven't heard before. And so that was the impetus for the book. And coincidentally, as I was writing the book, I became a grandmother for the first time, which was also kind of awesome. And so I was actually living what I was writing about in a number of ways. And so it just all sort of came together that way. But it really, the book started as an AARP project and sort of grew from there.
Oh, that is so interesting, and it's so nice that it's coincided with you becoming a grandparent. I don't have that yet myself, but I'm so aware of, you know, with the aging of the, quote, boomer population that, you know, so many people are, not everyone, but a lot of people are having that experience. And and even a while ago when Mark Friedman's book came out, How to Live Forever, you know, he really was talking about grandparenting. I know you mentioned him toward the end of your book, too. And just that, you know, it's like a segment of the population that people don't think about in terms of what can be provided, as well as sort of the role they play in just the purchasing.
Well, I mean, you know, next year, 2020, like a third of American households will be grandparent households.
Wow. I mean, that is amazing.
I mean, so, you know, there are a lot of grandparents out there, and there are a lot of, you know, there's a lot of issues. I mean, there's a lot of, it's like the most positive life change that comes in later life, or one of the most positive, but it also, there are also grandparents who really have issues that need to be addressed policy wise and by state and, you know, state and federal government. So it's just it's really compelling to look at and to think about. So that's the book, and I hope people take away from it because I tried to touch on the policy issues, but it really is a book about this life shift as a consumer economy.
Right. And you do focus on, I mean, it's excellent the way you focus on some of the policy issues but I love the perspective that you have, that it's thinking about it in terms of both what grandparents can contribute, but also recognizing that they need, it's a force to be reckoned with, and we, you know, and needs to be taken care of, because too many grandparents are doing the grandparenting because of the opioid epidemic. I mean, not the case everywhere, but that's a big, big, you know, part of it, so that there's a lot of trauma associated with it. Mm-hmm. So I know that, you know, as you said, you started in marketing and advertising, and what has it been like for you to now sort of move to doing all of this research and consulting with companies?
Yeah.
What's that been like?
Well, it's you know, it's interesting because the first agency that I worked in that was focused on older adults was with Ken Dykewald when Ken had AgeWave Impact, which was a full service ad agency that was part of the AgeWave family. And as everyone probably knows, Ken is very research oriented. And, you know, in my previous life in just general advertising, I had a lot of focus in healthcare, and we were very research driven there as well. So research had always sort of been, I was a copywriter when I started in the field, and it had always sort of been part of my background, because I think great research makes great marketing campaigns. I mean, when you're informed by consumer, you know, needs and opinions and lifestyle issues, you just create better advertising. And so I always loved having research as a fundamental base. And when I got to AgeWave, it was like over the top. We were really immersed in research for all of our clients. And it was just more interesting to me than being a creative, to be honest. I loved copywriting, and I do love to write, but I find consumers fascinating, and I love hearing people's stories. And what we did in particular for the Hacking Longevity study was you know, we did 12 focus groups, but we also, after the national survey was completed, we went into people's homes and visited people in their homes. And first of all, it's such an honor to be invited into someone's home, but you learn so much more from consumers when you are sitting in their home, hearing them talk about their daily life and, you know, what they worry about and what's going well. And, you know, there's just, you get such a different perspective. And so I feel like the work that I'm doing now is, it's very much applied research. It has a definite intent to help the companies that are our sponsors and the companies that come to our presentations do better marketing, develop better products. And so we're doing it with that intention. It's not just research for the sake of research, which I also love to do, but you know, and that also has tremendous value. But so the work we're doing has clear intent to be used by companies to be better at creating products and services for older adults.
And are you finding companies receptive to the research that
Really interesting, because I got started in this space, I'm going to say about 25 years ago now, and they weren't that receptive. I mean, there were categories that were. Financial services knew that it was important to wrangle baby boomers, you know, and pharmaceutical companies knew that older adults were important. But general consumer categories like, you know, clothing and food products and to some extent healthcare, you know beauty products, you know, just name a category, they really didn't think older consumers were very important. And in fact, you know, the fact that the research studies that most advertising agencies and marketing people look at end at age 55 would tell you how unimportant they think older adults are.
Right.
I mean, and some of them that wouldn't even look at numbers older than 45. So, you know, when I first started doing this, it was like, you know, before you could sell them any services or any research or anything, you had to convince them that this market was important and that the people were still vital and healthy and young and spending money. And you know, one of the toughest struggles we ever had at AgeWave Impact was convincing manufacturers of cars that older adults are still buying cars, even though they owned the statistics that said people buy more cars after the age of 50 than they do before the age of 50. And this was their own research. You know, it's like, read your own research. So, you know, back in those days, it was tough to get people to hear the message. And so, and consequently, you know, all the need for products and services and things that could have made, you know, people could have gotten a much earlier start on making the effects of aging better for people. I mean, if they had started then, now all of a sudden, I feel like 3 or 4 years ago, we hit this tipping point. And I think it is the aging of the baby boomers and the size of the demographic. I also think there's some awareness by marketers that, you know, who are all about millennials now and the size of the millennial market are going, well, wait a minute, that their parents' market is just as big as they are. So now people are looking at these two huge populations, you know, who are literally sandwiching in Generation X and saying, wow, you know, we need to be looking at the effect that these two generations have on each other, which we found in the hacking study was pretty important, that, you know, the recommendations back and forth between different generations of consumers has gotten to be a lot more important. And we think, you know, social media and technology has driven a lot of that. So, you know, in some households, you know, the older adult may be the person who actually puts the money forward to pay for things, but a younger adult may be the person who's done all the research and discovery and recommendations to the older adult. And vice versa, it goes the other way too. So it's pretty interesting. It's a really interesting time to be in this space.
Yeah, no, it really is. And what I find so intriguing about your work is, and I want you to talk more about the Hacking Longevity and how also you came up with that title, Hacking Longevity. but I think people are recognizing that the reality is that more and more people are really living into the 90s, 100 plus, and part of what you've been looking at is really this you know, the intergenerational, the three generations. So maybe share, and I know that I can't see the slides, but I understand there's a slide up there. Maybe talk about, if you would, the study and what you've been learning from it, and how, you know, how you mentioned a little of how you approached it with focus groups, but I think the listeners, my hunch is that not very many of them are aware of it. Maybe a few have looked at your website, but
about almost 2 years ago, I was doing another study directly for a client. And it was all in-home interviews. We did probably 30 in-home interviews across the country. And this client was trying to figure out what need gaps there were, like what products and services could be developed to help older adults just sort of navigate daily life. That was the question. And as we were doing that research, we saw people doing amazing things that we sort of called life, you know, we call them life hacks on a daily basis, but they were doing, you know, really interesting things to sort of hack their way through problems that they were facing every day with products. It was everything from how to get packages open, you know, which like clamshell packaging or the packaging of their hearing aid batteries or even the clasps on some of the pill containers and things they were doing to manage those little tiny activities of everyday life to, you know, how they were using and sort of hacking the GPS system in their car to figure out how to get all their errands done in one day. And we were just fascinated by the way older adults were finding ways to sort of game the system a little bit and really work through some of the problems that they were having. And so I sort of just filed that away. And then when we were approached to do this study that we're talking about today, I said, you know, I have this idea about how people are, first of all, people are living longer. And I don't know that people really I don't know that any generation really is recognizing the fact that they could live a 100-year life. And so I want to understand, one, if people have any response to that, if it even resonates with them. And two, what are they doing in their daily lives to make sure that they get there in the healthiest way possible? Or if they're doing anything, if there's anything out there. And then we really wanted to look at things like, you know, pre-retirement, retirement, housing, finances, kind of the whole gamut. But in this context of you could live to be 100 and how are you navigating your way through that? So that was sort of that's how hacking began. Yeah. And as I said earlier, we did 12 focus groups in 2 markets. We did a 2,100 plus person survey, and we went into people's homes in 2 different markets and did interviews afterwards. It was started in the fall of 2017. It was released last April of 2018, and we have had so much data. We have had a ton of data to analyze, but we really looked at 3 separate generations. We looked at Generation X, we looked at baby boomers, and we looked at the silent generation. And we found some just, you know, pretty interesting changes in the market because, you know, we've been doing research a long time now. And so we have kind of a set of hypotheses about kind of what we think we're going to learn. And some of what we thought we would learn, we didn't. And some of what we did learn, we were surprised about. And why don't we go ahead and go to the next slide? This sort of breaks down, this next slide is kind of the 3 buckets that we looked at. And one of the first things we wanted to understand was what was motivating people in terms of their decision making about a number of things, where they lived, how they lived, whether they were working or not working. And, you know, as you see, and as you might expect, because Gen X are parents and they're still in the workplace. Financial security is their number one motivator, and then enjoyment of life, and then health and fitness was number three. You know, and as we went up the age ladder, you know, baby boomers identify health and fitness as number one and financial security as number two. And that was a big insight, because we all know from the financial services industry that there's not enough savings for baby boomers to have secure retirements, and not all of them, but many of them. And I'll tell you where we found the exception. But something we found, these weird little life shift bumps all along the aging continuum, and around 53, baby boomers were, or I'm sorry, about 56, baby boomers were kind of flipping a switch. And they just sort of decided that their financial issues were going to be what they were going to be. And they didn't really feel like they could impact them. At 56 years old, they didn't feel like they could impact their financial security later in life, which kind of was scary to me as an insight. And they're going to this health and fitness as their motivating force. That was a kind of a big whoa. and I think a big opportunity for financial services to intervene and say, if you say you're going to work until you're in your 70s, you've got 20, you could have potentially 20 years to impact what's going to happen with your retirement savings. So I think that was a really big insight. We also found out the silent generation really, while the boomers sort of pay lip service to good health and fitness, and when I say lip service, I mean they say that they're focused on it, but the reality of their daily lives is that they're not doing very much. I mean, just little incremental things, but not where the silent generation is actually taking much better care of themselves. And we found out, it was largely because they've had some kind of health event that sort of scared them. And some of these were pretty minor, like a minor surgery or a minor illness. But some of them were kind of major. And so they were like all of a sudden looking at this and going, if I'm going to live 20, 30 more years, I got to take better care of myself. So this was just sort of the motivations we thought were kind of interesting. And what also came forward looking at Generation X was this whole new generation of caregivers, which if we want to go to the next slide, I just sort of summarized some of the big takeaways from this. But I guess the biggest one was that all generations sort of realize that longer lives are likely, but they're not doing very much to prepare for it. And in fact, in our focus groups, when we started the study, we asked people to come in. Everyone had a placemat, kind of a blank mat on the table in front of them. And we asked them to write down what age they want to live to. And people gasped when we asked this question. Like, how long do you want to live? And people were like, and we actually had a couple of ladies say, I'm not writing that down. We're like, well, it's not like we have a pipeline to anybody that's going to put an expiration date on your head.
Really superstitious, right.
Yeah, really superstitious. Yeah. It's like, I'm not writing that number down. But we asked people that, and what we found out is people take the age of their oldest living relative or whoever's been in their life as a much older adult and sort of uses that as their jumping off point for how long they want to live. And whether that person is aging successfully, like if they've had somebody in their life with dementia or a really difficult chronic illness, then they'll say, you know what, I'm going to be ready at 85 because after 85, nothing good happens. You know, I mean, people literally said that. And then we had other people who said, hey, you know, I want to live as long as I possibly can, as long as I have my mind and I'm in reasonably good physical condition. So it ran the gamut. But the behaviors before about the age of 75, there's not a lot of behavioral change going on to make sure that a 100-year life is sustainable. So that was interesting. We already talked about
it.
But, you know, this has been true of every piece of research we've done about baby boomers. to be honest, is they, baby boomers are smart and they know they should be doing certain things. As you know, and I hate to use generational, just sort of lump all these people together, because there are definitely, there's definitely a segment of very high functioning planning personalities in the baby boomer generation. But baby boomers as a generation overall have seemed to, you know, embrace a lot of knowledge about what they should be doing, but acting on it takes a major life event usually to get them to really respond and react. And then we go to Gen X.
Well, but before you jump to Gen X, I have one question here from John from Springfield, and it seems like it relates to the more to the boomers. So what's interesting is you say that regardless of financial status in their, you know, mid-50s, boomers tend to switch more to, you know, health and wellness and less focus on finances. But so John's question is, what are you seeing in terms of people delaying their retirements for both positive reasons and maybe not so positive reasons? Did that come up at all of people?
That's a great question. And I made a note about that this morning as I was thinking about this, because I didn't put it on the key takeaways and I should have. So it was really interesting, because one of the analyses that we've been doing lately on this set of data is the differences between people who are in sort of a pre-retired state and a retired state, and sort of the happiness level and how it kind of changed their responses. So we found two really distinct buckets in the baby boomer segment. One were these people who aren't retired yet. They're not particularly happy with what they're doing right now, but they have to keep working. And that was for a number of reasons. Some of them were taking care of multiple generations of family members. Whether they were living with them or not, they were helping to provide something for multiple generations of their family. They're worried about what they lost in the recession in terms of their retirement accounts, so they're trying to bolster their retirement accounts. Or they're just plain happy working. And we found that segment to be far more female than male. And when we took that back out into our interviews and our discussions, we found a lot of women who said, look, it took me a long time to get to this place in my career where I'm managing, I feel confident about what I'm doing, I'm making the money I expected to be making 10 years ago, and why would I go away now? I mean, we heard a lot of that from women. And, you know, a lot of women saying, you know, I took 10 years. Some said I took 10 years off when I was raising children, and it took me a while to get my career revved back up. And, you know, I'm happier than I've ever been. And some of them had husbands retired at home who, you know, were happily retired at home. And they would say, you know, I'm not ready to just be home every day. I kind of like the fact that my husband's doing the grocery shopping now and taking care of things at home, and it's a nice trade-off. It's nice for me to have this time of my life where I'm the one earning and my husband gets to be at home, and so it was just sort of a really subtle role change that everybody was really kind of happy about. The people who were continuing to work and were really worried were people who did not have fixed benefit pension plans. And the people who were really happy retired and had retired at what we thought was kind of young based on our original hypotheses had come from government jobs, large corporate jobs, companies that still had pretty healthy fixed benefit pensions. They were teachers, postal workers, you know, IBM, Hewlett-Packard, you know, those kind of employees who had really secure retirements. And, you know, that's where we found more second homes, you know, vacation homes, things like that. So that was a pretty stark difference. And those people were really happy with their retirement. They were like, you know, I've got time to go to the gym. I have time to to go and like browse through the grocery store. You know, I'm exercising every day. You know, they were really like embracing the non-work thing. And then they found some people sort of in this weird way station, kind of sandwiched in the middle of all of this, who were some of the people in this weird way station felt like they'd been pushed out of jobs because of ageism. We heard the ageist issues pretty frequently, and ironically heard them a lot from Generation X, which I thought was really fascinating. But we saw a lot of baby boomers at this kind of weird midpoint who were either feeling pushed out of a job, they were about to leave a job, and they were trying to decide either what to do next as a volunteer or for paid work, or whether or not they should start a business. And they were looking for resources for older people starting businesses, because we heard a lot from people in this way station about, you know, when a lot of the stuff for startups is all focused on young people starting businesses and how to live on the cheap when you're 20 years old and you want to start a business, or 30 years old and you want to start a business. But nobody's talking to older adults about, should you leverage your, you know, your retirement fund to start a business, and how could that impact you when you're older? And so they had a lot of issues in this weird middle space. We also found a lot of people consulting back to the businesses that they previously worked for, and were surprisingly happy with that arrangement because they didn't have to deal with office politics and what they considered the BS of the day-to-day in their office. They just had to do the job that they used to do and the parts of it they liked. So some of that was seen as positive. There were other people who looked at that as negative. They felt like their old employer was getting away with paying them less money for doing the same work. So there was that middle ground was not a particularly happy group of people.
Right.
But the people we saw on the other side of that who had become entrepreneurs, who had purchased, you know, small businesses, who were doing consulting and had been at it for a while, they had a pretty high happiness factor. They felt pretty good about what they were doing and felt like they could do what they were doing, you know, into their like late 70s, even early 80s, which we found kind of astounding.
I think that does, I mean, it makes a lot of sense. I mean, I always say the finances, you know, do have, you know, kind of a buttress so that, you know, if there's options and, you know, sometimes the finances and health give options, and without either the good health or the finances, there's less options and it just feels like
exactly.
You're caught or squeezed or
exactly.
Whatever. Yeah. Right.
Exactly.
Say more too. You were starting to say, and I interrupted you with the question. But what kind of things were you finding from Gen Xers? You mentioned that. I mean, it's interesting that they, you know, and it makes sense. But maybe speak more how they experience the ageism of being younger.
Yeah. So you know, Generation X is a relatively small generation. They're kind of like the Silent Generation was compressed between the World War II generation and baby boomers. The Gen Xers are sandwiched between the millennials, which are a huge generation, and the baby boomers. And so they're a much smaller segment. They're sandwiched between these Goliath populations, and they're starting to feel like, because of the sheer size of the millennials and the millennials' willingness to sort of try new things and move around in jobs and not worry so much about security, they worry about getting bounced out. They're worried about getting pushed out of their jobs earlier than they want to be, which we thought was really interesting for people in their late 40s and early 50s. You know, they talk about millennials coming on board at their businesses, and they don't so much, you know, I think a lot of the generational warfare stories that make the headlines, you know, I think there's always a grain of truth in them. I don't think they're nearly in most organizations as exaggerated as they sound, but we did hear some things about, you know, the differences in the culture of the generation and how Gen Xers are just really feeling pushed. They're also feeling pushed by baby boomers coming back into work, which was another interesting artifact of this study. It's like, you know, they'd say, you know, this person was in my way for the last 5 years. They finally left the company, and I finally got promoted to the job I should be in, and now all of a sudden they're consulting back to the company, and how am I supposed to get respect from the people I'm managing when this person's still hanging around? So they're feeling sandwiched by the baby boomers coming back into these jobs too, which I thought was another interesting thing. And they also commented a lot about how they'd seen their baby boomer coworkers treated by the companies that they were in, and how they felt like ageism was really present in companies. And they saw it at work, and so that was making them worry about themselves. And so, and the population that seemed the most worried about it were single women who were like 48 to 52, because, you know, they're sort of like, I take care of myself. I don't have a spouse to lean on, and so I can't afford to get pushed out before my time. I need to work as long as I need to work. And so we found Gen X women really kind of struggling with this and worrying the most about their financial health. Of any subsegment throughout this study, it was women at around the age of 50 who had the most financial worry. And then, you know, the other thing that was really happening to is really happening to Gen X is they're becoming caregivers for the first time. And all of a sudden they're experiencing the, you know, the fact that they're finally getting where they want to be in their careers, or they're still just a little bit underemployed, and now they have this caregiving issue pulling them away from their focus. And, you know, just when we thought that it was okay to go to work and talk about caregiving with your employer and the EAP program and everything, we're finding out that Gen Xers are really struggling with talking about this at work, just the way baby boomers reported, you know, 20 years ago when they were beginning to go through caregiving. So not much has changed on that level, in spite of the fact that there are more programs available to employers. There's more discussion about caregiving and the role that people are playing in the lives of older adults. It just seems like people are still really feeling pressured at work when they have, and some of this, when we drilled down on it in focus groups, we found out was self-made pressure, but some of it seemed like very real pressure in the workplace to just needing to be, you know, in their jobs, in their chairs, working and focused and feeling like they couldn't be. And so what we found was this new generation of caregivers are really very open to using all types of technology to help them manage their caregiving. They talk about.
Can you elaborate on that a little bit more?
Yeah.
Like what kind?
They're like, you know, it started with little things like, I taught my mother how to text so she wouldn't call me four times a day. You know, so that was like one of the minor, simpler things, all the way up to, you know, I'm using an app to find someone to bring in 2 hours a day. I'm using home food delivery, like I'm using things like Amazon groceries. I'm using Instacart. I'm using, you know, complete meal plans. You know, it was all kinds of things. I can't take my mom to a doctor's appointment, but I can call Uber and have Uber pick her up and take her to the doctor appointment. So they're very willing to what I kind of called outsourcing. they're right. Really willing to use technology to outsource their caregiving responsibilities. And I don't say that with any judgment. I mean, it's one of the hacks, right? It's one of the ways they're hacking through this. And, you know, they're struggling with it. And then at the older end, you know, we found 70-year-olds who were taking care of 90-year-old parents and having similar discussions. I mean, some of these 70-year-olds are like, I'm at the end of my career. I want to go out with a bang. You know, I want to end on a high note. And I've got my mom living with me now. Or I've got my mom in a skilled nursing community, and how am I supposed to navigate stopping there twice a day and, you know, finish my job. And, oh, by the way, I'm kind of tired. I'm funny about that. I don't have the energy level that I had when I was 50 or 40.
Right.
And so we saw that happening too. So it was
that's where some of the policies, the lack of policy kind of plays into that.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. So it, you know, that the whole caregiving thing, I think, you know, I was really feeling very positive about all the changes that have our ability to talk about caregiving, people's willingness to be open about the fact that they're doing it. And I thought things had really changed. And I sort of feel like the more things change, the more they stay the same. we still aren't making the kind of progress that we need to make given the size and the scale of the population.
Right. Which seems like it's leading you into this newer study, which in a minute I want to have you share.
Yeah.
I just want to remind people, if you want to submit questions, go to the event page and you could submit questions that I will integrate. And again, for those of you who came on late, don't worry if you're not able to see the few slides that we have, because they're up there on the event page and you'll be able to see them. You'll be able to see them, you know, when you listen to the recording or see them on the event page. So I just wanted to say that for those of you who came in. So maybe we should shift now about, you know, the more recent study that you've gone into, because
sure.
You know, my understanding is it's more on these life shifts.
Yes, and I'll just tell you a little bit about how we got here. So one of the outputs of the last study, we finished the study in time for AARP's Living 100 event in D.C., and for that event, we created an enormous graphic that showed all of the sort of tremors between the ages of like 35 and to 100, all of the sort of little subtle things that happen along the way to sort of shift your focus, shift your emphasis, shift your motivations. And it was a really compelling chart. But what we began to see between the ages of about 45 and 75 were some pretty big buckets that we wanted to dive deeper into and really create a lot of up-to-date learning in. So could we go to the next slide? And I'll show you what those five are. And so what we're doing this year is another huge study, but we've got five mini studies inside of this huge undertaking. And so we're looking at caregiving, at aging single, at grandparenting, career and encoring, and changes in living situation. These all had really compelling insights around them. I talked to probably a little bit more about caregiving than anything else, but you know, we want to look at the differences between the different kinds of caregiving that are going on, whether it's for a spouse or partner, other family members, you know, kind of what's happening between the generations there. We heard in focus groups and in interviews some really subtle things about where people are going to live and how people are going to navigate caregiving for older adults. And the one thing that we discovered was nobody understands how skilled nursing is cared for or is paid for. No one understands long-term care insurance in any compelling way. And nobody really knows how senior living gets paid for. And, you know, when we talk to people, you know, question people about things like CCRCs and assisted living and skilled nursing, you know, a lot of people think Medicare covers these things. It's like, no.
Okay.
You know? And yeah. So there's a lot of misunderstanding about who pays for even things like home visits and hospice and how any of this gets covered by insurance. So there was just a lot going on in the caregiving space that we felt like deserved a much deeper, much more focused dive. Aging single is an area I have never had a chance to dive into, and I am probably most excited about this. You know, a friend of mine wrote a great book about you know, aging without children and
right.
and I just am fascinated by this segment, and mostly because the for the first time in the boomer population really has a pretty large proportion of people who are going into older age on their own, either because of divorce or widowhood or just the decision to be single. So, you know, we heard about a lot of issues with blended families and legacy and who takes care of whom in the caregiving roles when people are aging on their own. And there's just a lot in here we want to dive into and uncover. And we want to really understand how people who are, if people who are aging on their own are planning differently financially and kind of what that model looks like, and you know, whether they're worried about issues of isolation and loneliness, and which seems to be, it seems to cut across every generation at any age. I mean, we saw, you know, we heard people at the youngest end of Generation X talk about how isolated they feel on a daily basis. So, you know, it's not just an artifact of aging, I think. I think it's probably potentially an artifact of our digital lives, but it's not just getting older.
Apparently. I think you're right. And I should just mention, just before you move on to that, for those of you who've been part of the calls before, just, I mean, I did interview Sarah Ozef Geber when her book on solo aging, and also Joy Leverode on Who Will Take Care of Me When I'm Old. It's such an important area. So I just wanted to kind of underscore
that. Both fantastic books. Both of those ladies. I'm a huge fan of both of them.
Yeah, me too.
they're both amazing. Grandparenting, this is kind of my jam, but we found out a lot of things are going on with grandparents, and we really want to understand this whole, you know, where the spending's coming in. We found out in this study that the things that I learned writing the book about grandparents spending on, like, normal daily expenses have not gone away since the recession. You know, grandparents stepped in to pay those and nothing has changed. So we're trying to figure out why that hasn't changed. We want to know more about the effect of the opioid epidemic. We want to, you know, we just want to dive into grandparenting in a deeper way. And then career and encoring is sort of a new space for me too. I personally have not done a lot of research. There are a lot of smart people like Mark Friedman who really focus here, but we want to do sort of an understanding of what's going on in people's careers, how age is or isn't affecting that, careers versus jobs. And we heard a lot of older adults say, I don't want a second career, I just want a job. And so we want to understand what that dynamic is a little bit, when people expect to retire and why, you know, why that number. Anytime people throw out a number at me like, oh, at 75, I'm going to do this, I always want to know why. Like, what's going on there? Why is that number important to you? With men, we find out, we heard a lot that's, you know, the age that their father passed. And so they're like, I don't want to work past that age. I want to have some time left to enjoy myself. And we also heard a lot about volunteerism among our Silent Generation respondents in Hacking One. And so we want to know more about volunteering. We purposely have not used the word purpose here because we found out it was sort of a loaded word for some people, because some people said, I just want to have a life. I don't need a big purpose. I just want my life. And so it kind of bothered us that people didn't think that their lives were purposeful, just the stuff they were doing on a daily basis. So we've left the term purpose out of this equation because it felt a little loaded, but we did see a lot of acts of volunteerism and a lot of, you know, people who are literally volunteering in the number of hours that a job would take up in their lives. So we want to look at that. And this whole change in living situation, you know, we've seen so many headlines about baby boomers are downsizing, baby boomers aren't downsizing. You know, kids are moving back home, kids aren't moving back up. You know, there's so much kind of, not misinformation, but a lot of differing opinions about what's going on there. So we want to understand really what's happening. We want to understand what's going on, if the empty nest is really creating a downsize epidemic or not. We want to know what's motivating people to move to senior communities, or if people are motivated to move to senior communities. ironically, Generation X told us in the surveys that if they needed a senior community, they would be happy to move to a senior community, which we thought was bizarre. Mm-hmm. I mean, like, where is this coming from? And it was like 40%. Yeah. You know? And so those were higher numbers than we've ever seen in any previous generation. Mm-hmm. So,
well, that's so interesting, too, because – oh, go ahead.
No, go. We just want to know what's going on here.
Yeah. Well, it's so interesting because, you know, more and more, it seems like more and more boomers are saying they want to be in they don't want to be in segregated communities.
Or right.
I'm hearing this more. But you're saying Gen Xers are saying they want to be. So that's just, I find it really interesting.
Yeah. I'd be happy to move to a senior community. I'm like, really? Have you ever been to one? How do you know that? That's really interesting because, you know, boomers have been so, you know, I'll never move to one of those communities, that we were sort of interested in a deeper understanding of why that number was so high among Gen Xers. Anyway,
it's fascinating to think about. Yeah, maybe when you're saying that Gen Xers are worried about finances, and particularly women, I mean, thinking about, you know, some people do talk about the senior or 55 and older communities or CCRCs as kind of camp for adults where everything's taken care of, kind of thing. And it may just feel very protective, protected and protective. I mean, it's sort of interesting.
We did hear some of that from women in particular. Yeah. You know, it's like, you know, we're kind of excited to know that there are places we can go and that everything is paid for and we know what the expenses are going to be on a monthly basis. You know, people talk about everything from downsizing to condos to moving into senior living. And so we thought that was really, this whole what motivates people to change their living situation would be really interesting, and how their health experiences really inform that decision, I think, is, you know, are there declines in health that help, you know, that factor in here. We know at the oldest end of the age range, of course, when people have to move to assisted living, we know that that's a health challenge. But is health a factor at any of these other levels? So, and, you know, we also, as part of this, have seen this enormous issue around getting rid of stuff. You know, how the whole downsizing and getting rid of things and how people are managing to downsize their lives, which is, you know, just an enormous, getting rid of stuff is a huge issue.
Mm-hmm. Yes, very huge issue. One I'm involved in myself right now. These certainly are five really big, important life shifts that you're focusing on. It makes me wonder, what are you finding? You know, it sounds like you've, you know, over the course of your work, as well as this new research, you've met a lot of entrepreneurs and companies that are constantly creating new products and services for different ages. I mean, not just older adults, I guess, but for all of the ages, but, you know, specifically for the older adults. What are there any that have been really, really interesting that have stuck out for you of kind of the way the trend is going?
Well, you know, I think some, and I say this to my consulting clients a lot, sometimes the solutions here are much more simple than technology solutions, but I think, you know, when all you have is a hammer, every problem looks like a nail. So, you know, it's sort of like everyone wants to throw technology at a lot of these issues when sometimes these are really simple people solutions. Mm-hmm. I think, you know, caregiving, aging singly, and grandparenting are, I think, real people-oriented, multi-generational solution that we as a country have gotten away from solving things with multiple generations of family. Mm-hmm. And I would love to see us be back in that place again, live much more like our ancestors did, and with the nuclear family closer by for everyone. So I think that to the whole shift in the discussion around multi-gen, I think,
right.
whether you're related and whether you're related or not, just having multiple mm-hmm. generations of people living together, you know,
right.
working side by side, I think is really compelling. But on the technology right. side, which is what most people care about, I think, you know, I think the devices that we saw in people's homes, like it was right after Christmas when we went into people's homes to do interviews, and mm-hmm. everyone had an Echo. Everyone had gotten an mm-hmm. Echo or a Google Home for Christmas from their children, and they were excited to show us what you could do with the Amazon Echo. mm-hmm. And, you know, it was so, you know, a lot of what people were doing were just things like listening to music or finding recipes, mm-hmm. but there were people who were ordering groceries. There were people mm-hmm. doing other, you know, they were doing other kinds of life hacks. So leaving medication mm-hmm. reminders for themselves, setting timers, you know, they were using it to do some pretty interesting things. So I think the whole movement of voice first devices, mm-hmm. where people can, it doesn't require understanding a computer, it doesn't understand, you know, it doesn't mean you have to have a laptop in the home. Right. You can just talk to something and get answers back or get solutions yeah. to problems. I think that's huge. I think that is mm-hmm. enormous for people who are older and also for people with disabilities. So that's mm-hmm. a big one. I love some of the virtual reality platforms that I'm seeing. Embodied Labs, Carrie Shaw mm-hmm. at Embodied Labs is one of my young adult heroes. She used her mother's illness when she was a teenager to create virtual reality experiences so that caregivers can understand what a person with dementia is going through in virtual mm-hmm. reality. And it is creating so much more empathy and better training for professional caregivers, but it's also letting family members understand more about what they could be doing to serve the person that they're trying so hard to care for and are frustrated. You know, they get frustrated with people. I mean, caregiving can be a very isolating and frustrating experience, and virtual reality and really understanding what the older adult is going through, I think, creates an empathy that's very different from where we've been in understanding some of these things. She's got, I think, dementias and Alzheimer's are the big ones, but she's working on Lewy body and some other things. And she's just an amazing woman. I mean, I think the work she's doing is just phenomenal. So I'm really
excited. Can you say her name again? Her name and
Carrie Shaw. Carrie with a C, Carrie Shaw. And her company is called Embodied, Embodied Labs.
Uh-huh. Labs.
And she's won some major pitch events and some awards. Mm. And she's just a really very quiet, unassuming young woman who is brilliant and in the way that she thought about this market. And I'm really excited to see where she goes next.
So Rosemary from Florida just has a comment. She said, you know, even though boomers are saying maybe they don't want to move into retirement communities, she lives in Florida, and she says the over 55 communities are what are being built, and they're full
yep.
of baby boomers. So maybe people are you know, saying what they don't want, but then doing it. You know, kind of.
Right. So. And I think senior housing has responded to baby boomers doing the oh hell no by trying mm-hmm. to create different models of products. I mean, the old model is with a community built around a golf course and with a big clubhouse and swimming pool. But there are a lot of new models. There are models that don't have the golf amenities because not everybody's a golfer. They may have demonstration cooking kitchens. They may have, you know, and more of a programming orientation. So there's all, you know, there's a lot of new models emerging that I think baby boomers will be more excited about. And I think the Florida, Arizona retirement centers, I don't think those are going away. I think there are, you know, there are very traditional baby boomers who still are very drawn to that model of living. But I think the new developments that are coming online are really interesting. And there are even builders right now who are building for everyone, who are building multi-generational houses that are literally built from the ground up for multiple generations of family to live in them. They're like two houses under one roof, basically. Mm. And so that's kind of an exciting trend, too.
That is. Huh. Yeah. A question from Faye from New York. She says, great coverage of topics and sharing research. And she says, now getting to the getting rid of stuff. You mentioned desk cleaning on your website. Would you please give us two successful tips to get started? Could be a new career path for some of us who are good at doing this.
Yeah. Actually, it's a really great question because I got to speak at the Association of National Senior Move Managers. I didn't even know this was a thing until they called me and asked me to come speak to them. And I was fascinated by this because it's an association. These are people who work as professionals to help older adults clean out, you know, the closets, the drawers, get rid of their stuff. And it is a career and a profession. And there are a lot of women at midlife who are drawn to this profession because that's who was in the audience for this. And, you know, one of the things that I learned going to the sessions there was that it's often good to have a non-family member come in to talk to an older adult, because the older adult feels nagged by family members to get rid of things. And it's sort of a, you know, like a Greek chorus of people going, oh, you need to empty that, and you need to empty this, you need to get rid of that, and you don't need this anymore. And the older adult just becomes paralyzed by that. They get tired of hearing it. But when someone comes in from the outside who is empathetic and has a process for doing it and shows a lot of understanding of what that older adult is going through, then it takes that burden off of the family. It takes that sort of annoyance factor away and makes it cleaner and simpler. It's never an easy process, but these women are professionals and they've got these checklists and ideas and places you go to get rid of furniture and pianos and all the things that older adults are trying to give away to their children that their children and grandchildren just don't want. Mm-hmm. You know, mm-hmm. That's the highest rated story on Next Avenue last year was your kids don't want your stuff.
Yeah, right. I remember reading that. It's
true. That should tell us something, right? I mean, it's a really it's a big deal. So I think having professionals who do this is it's an amazing thing, and I think there's only room for growth in that category because you know, one of the things that they talked about was how hard it is for senior living to get people to move, because they don't know how to get rid of the things they have to be able to downsize to go to an apartment. So people aren't getting the services and the health care support they need that they could be having in senior living because they don't know how to get rid of their stuff. That, to me, is a really good reason for to hire one of these people to say, let's, you know, these women come in and they'll say, okay, how big is the apartment you're going to? Well, here's about how much furniture you're going to need for that apartment. Let's walk around and pick your favorite pieces and the things you'd like to, you know, go in there. And so they have this wonderful process for doing that. I think that's amazing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, that's it. Great advice on that. And Sarah from Woodstock says, my husband and I are not parents, so I'm looking forward to your next book on hacking. When will it come out?
So everyone's asking me that.
No pressure.
I had to go to Maine and lock myself away for 3 weeks to write this one. So that, you know, I'd love to have that 3 weeks to go do again. But I do think after we're done with this study that I will have enough for a next book, and it will be a hacking longevity book. And so I'm going to tentatively say 2020, and my publisher will be happy to hear that too.
Yeah, you know? Right.
Because right. they've been asking.
So. Yeah. Well, I think people will be very interested in reading, and I know I will be too, and Sarah just said she will. So one last question, and then a final maybe takeaway from you. But do you think that the speed of innovation in the longevity space is fast enough? Or, you know, I have no idea how long it takes, you know, for
yeah.
products to be approved and stuff. I mean, what's, can you share a little of your sense of that?
Well, no.
Okay.
I don't think it's fast enough, and I think we have some deterrents to that. One is, and this is probably one people don't really think about, but one is that the process to get, a lot of people are coming up with great technology and great ideas to help people, particularly with healthcare, but until you can figure out who's going to pay for that, you know, who the payer is going to be, whether it's going to be insurance or whether it's going to be an individual or whether it's going to be Medicaid or Medicare, until we figure out that you can get that equation figured out, a lot of these things get stuck and never come to market. And it's sad, but it costs hundreds of thousands of dollars to hire a lobbyist to get a Medicare reimbursement code created for you. So,
really?
So,
wow.
Yeah. It's very difficult to get onto Medicare's schedule of reimbursement. It's a very arduous process. And I know some really great technologies that have died because they couldn't figure out how to get the thing paid for. On the other hand, there are some really unique partnerships that occur, you know, like auto insurance paying for older adults to have the Posit Science Brain HQ software available to them so that they can do brain training to help people be safer on the road longer. That to me is a really unique partnership. Individuals aren't having to pay for the service themselves. The auto insurance companies are paying for it. So, so you know, there are some things that some smart companies are doing to get there, but it just, you know, it takes a long time. A lot of the things that are getting created for older adults get created without the older adult involved, and that hampers innovation. You know,
right.
we have companies come to us and go, here's this cool product that we created for old people. Can you tell us how to sell it? And it's like, I mean, first thing I say to some of these people is, who asked you for this? I mean, you've got, this is an answer without a question. did you do your research on the competitors? Because there are, you know, 80, I can give you a list of like 8 competitors that have already like done a much better job than what you just showed me. So, you know, a lot of the young companies coming into the market just aren't doing their homework. And so that hampers time to market. And then it's funding. You know, a lot of these things get funded by venture capitalists. Venture capitalists have not expressed an overwhelming interest in aging. They like healthcare, and they like healthcare devices with big audiences, but the longevity economy overall has 3 or 4 really interested VC relationships, and then the rest of them need a lot of education.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's, you know, I feel like part of my unpaid mission in this life is to make sure that they're well informed and to let them know how big the markets are and how important some of these things are and why they should be funding them.
Yeah, it sounds like that is such a difficult drawback on the whole thing. In with funding, policy, all of those things. So this has just been terrific. I just, again, want to remind people, when you get the recording link, go to the event page, and the slides are there as a handout, so you'll be able to read it. I've heard from a few people who came on a little late and hadn't heard me say that. So, Lori, before you give a final takeaway, can you just tell people how to reach you and how to get your book? And
the book is on Amazon, The Grandparent Economy. Thank you, anyone who buys it. I appreciate it. It goes into my grandchildren's college fund, just so you know. my website is thebusinessofaging.com, and there are resources, and there's a lot of information there. And you can always reach me at in my email, lori@thebusinessofaging.com, and I'm happy to answer questions, or if you saw something on here that sort of piques your interest later and you want to field a question, feel free to reach out.
Terrific. Thank you. Well, any final just comment or takeaway you'd like the listeners to have from you?
Well, I really enjoy doing webinars and teleseminars like this, because I want people to be as excited about the potential for aging in our world and the products and services being brought forward. And I want more people in this space. I want more smart people in this space focused on it. And I just congratulate all of you for choosing, to keep yourself informed in this way, with like hearing different kinds of speakers and different points of view. Because I just think we, a lot of the great solutions that have come forward in the last 10 years have been grassroots kinds of innovations and solutions. And, we can throw all the big money at things we want to, but it's the people who have the feet on the ground that are working with older adults every day who can really make the biggest difference in the fastest way.
Thank you. Well, thank you so much for taking the time and being here with us. And just thanks for taking the time and helping us really learn about an area that we haven't really focused on before. So I really am very appreciative. Thanks so much. Take care, everybody.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Revolutionize Your Retirement Radio with Dr. Dorian Mintzer. To learn more about the resources mentioned on today's show, listen to past episodes, or download our free retirement transition guide, visit revolutionizeyourretirementradio.com.